Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
Australia, in the global scale, is one of the largest exporters of coal and gas in the world. We are disproportionately responsible for global climate pollution.
UN Special Rapporteur has made an application to join legal cases challenging the North West Shelf extension. Also,
we do have a number of concerns, particularly in relation to, you know, the potential impact of co-contributions. For instance, you know, people will need to make a small payment to support showering at home, potentially.
The new Aged Care Act came into effect at the beginning of November. And later today,
the new antibiotic that has been approved for this summer is very controversial. It's called flosfenicol. And it has been used in Chile and salmon farms for a long time and has had big impacts on the marine environment.
Salmon sales are reportedly booming, while environmentalists warn of mass die-offs and antibiotics in our waterways. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a new program supported by the Queensland Council of Unions is providing free information sessions on work entitlements and visa protections for migrant workers. Around two-thirds of migrant workers have experienced wage theft while working in Australia, and the Queensland Migrant WorkWise program gives support to migrant workers providing information in different languages. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Marty Haidari and Lucia Demigian from Queensland Migrant WorkWise to find out more.
Our goal is to support migrant workers, including international students and working holiday makers, with information about their workplace rights and the new visas protections that help them to report exploitation safely.
We also run free information sessions to help workers understand how to safely report exploitation in their workplaces without putting their visa status at risk.
And what's the motivation behind creating QMWW?
We know migrant workers are at a higher risk of exploitation. Research shows that about two-thirds of migrant workers have experienced wage theft and one in four face other forms of exploitations, such as being pressured to do unsafe work. You know, but many of these migrant workers don't know where to turn to for help or fear speaking up because of their visa status.
Migrant workers are always afraid to lose their visa, lose their job. A lot of them don't speak a good English, don't know how to, if they can ask something for their employers or not. We are always afraid. And we bring to Australia our backgrounds from our own countries. And migrants need to understand in Australia there are different rules and they have rights as everybody else. If you work, you have rights in Australia.
That's right. And there's been a lot of instances where, you know, more likely international students and migrant workers are being exploited by companies. As mentioned, most migrants are unaware about their working rights in Australia. Why is this so important to raise awareness about?
It's important because knowing your rights and know where you can go for help, you can speak up. So as a migrant, we are always afraid because we don't know our rights. And when people don't know their rights, they are more vulnerable to underpayment, unsafe conditions, discrimination, and intimidation.
So migrant workers, as we know, are an essential part of the Queensland workforce, right? Their skills and hard work help fill critical labour shortages in industries like agriculture, meat processing, hospitality, and other important sectors like aged care. So supporting their rights and well-being isn't just the right thing to do for us here. It's vital for our communities and the Queensland economy.
Now, you mentioned that you do free information sessions once it's about working rights, but another important work you do is to offer sessions about visa protections, and you just briefly mentioned that. Could you please expand a little bit about this?
The Australian government has introduced new visa protections that allow migrant workers to report exploitation and take legal action safely, even if they have reached a work-related visa condition because of that exploitation. So there are two new visas in place. They are visas, they have the requirements, so you have to fill it up requirements, but they are new possibilities for who is a visa holder migrant worker to allow them to safely report exploitation. And we are not lawyers, we give like general information, but we do have in our program, we can refer migrant visa holders that are going through exploitation to the lawyers, to the IARC, Immigration Advice and Rights Center, and they will give the legal advice and go with the case.
So I'm assuming that a big part of your work is speaking with migrant workers and all that and refer them to specific support services and providing them with information in different languages. Am I correct?
Yes. So we currently have our information that gets delivered in English, but the material we have is available in 8 languages, including Arabic, Chinese, Punjabi, Nepalese, and Spanish. And we continue to expand that language support as the demand grows. Last night, I was at a community meeting with the Congolese community with Lucia, and we had someone from the community actually there to translate as we were talking. And it's very important for us to note that we can continue to offer this support and the materials in different languages so people can have access to their rights and information.
That was Outreach Officer from Queensland Migrant WorkWise, Marty Haidari, ending the report by The Wire's Eduardo Jordan.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Human Right to a Healthy and Sustainable Environment has filed an application to intervene in a federal court challenge to Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas project. The move would allow UN Special Rapporteur Astrid Puentes-Riano to offer information or expertise on the case and Australia's international legal obligations without being a party. The Australian Conservation Foundation says the government failed to properly consider the project's climate impacts, and the UN's move adds to growing international pressure on Australia's approach to major fossil fuel developments. To learn more about what this means for their case, I spoke to ACF climate and energy exports campaigner, Piper Rollins.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Right to a Clean, Healthy and Sustainable Environment has applied to make a submission, essentially to be a friend of the court in ACF's legal challenge against the Northwest Shelf extension to 2070. That's incredible for a few reasons. This is the first time in Australia that a UN Special Rapporteur has applied to join an Australian court case, and it really demonstrates the extent of the global interest and concern about Minister Murray Watt's approval of the Northwest Shelf gas project out to 2070. There's been a number of international voices, including former leaders of Vanuatu, a nation in the Pacific that's currently under threat of rising sea levels and climate change, calling out the Albanese government's decision to extend the Northwest Shelf gas project to 2070. And the UN Special Rapporteur joining our case is yet another example of just how globally significant and enormous the climate impacts from the Northwest Shelf extension will be. So at this stage, the Special Rapporteur is applying to essentially be an advisor. It's actually translated, the Latin word for her role is translated into friend of the court. So at this stage, she's just having a look at both sides' arguments, so ACF and Woodside's arguments in the case, and she will make her final decision about whether she will join the case in April. But the role that the Special Rapporteur would play in ACF's litigation is providing context to the Australian court system and our judge about what Australia's international legal obligations are, and any international legal obligations that we have to uphold human rights in relation to this approval. The Special Rapporteur could also help to contextualize the recent ruling from the International Court of Justice this year, which found that Australia cannot export its responsibility for the coal and gas emissions that we export overseas. This is really important because Australia is one of the largest exporters of coal and gas in the world, And the ICJ's ruling that we cannot export our responsibility for those emissions when that coal and gas is burned overseas means that Australia actually has to make some serious decisions here at home about the approval of new coal and gas projects.
The project itself, the Northwest Shelf, given that its lifetime emissions are nearly 10 times Australia's annual total, how should that factor into the decision?
ACF is going to argue that the 4 billion tonnes of climate pollution that will come out of the Northwest Shelf extension, which is equivalent to nearly 10 times Australia's annual emissions, had to be considered under our environment laws. That climate pollution that comes out of the Northwest Shelf will have impacts on the Great Barrier Reef, will have impacts on Ningaloo, and a whole heap of other matters of national environmental significance. Minister Murray Watt did not consider that climate pollution and its impacts on our nature when he was making his decision to approve the Northwest Shelf, and we reckon that that is unlawful. Minister Murray Watt got that wrong, and our court challenge will seek to overturn that decision, which allowed him to ignore the climate impacts of the Northwest Shelf extension and the impact that that pollution will have on matters of national environmental significance.
The decision for if the special rapporteur is allowed to intervene in the case, that won't be made until April. But what new international law context would the Australian court be forced to confront if that goes ahead?
The special rapporteur provides an advisor role. So currently, Australia has a bunch of obligations under international human rights law, and as this new ICJ ruling shows, potentially we have a whole bunch of obligations about the fossil fuel emissions that we export and our responsibility for considering those when we make decisions to approve coal and gas projects in Australia. So at this stage, the special rapporteur is a friend of the court. She's an advisor, and she will help provide advice to the judge about what our obligations are under international law and how those might be applied in our Australian court system.
And yeah, just finally, what does the case overall mean for the future of Australia's fossil fuel exports?
If successful, ACF's legal case could set a precedent that the climate pollution that comes from fossil fuel approvals, we could set a positive precedent that that climate pollution has to be considered when decisions are being made, whether or not to approve coal and gas projects. That would be monumental because currently our nature laws are not clear about whether or not those emissions need to be considered. We reckon in the instance of the Northwest Shelf extension, where there's 4 billion tonnes of climate pollution, that's equivalent to 10 times Australia's total annual emissions, that it is unreasonable, it just doesn't pass the pub test, that you could have that much pollution and not consider all of the impacts that it would have on Australian nature.
Piper Rowlands from the Australian Conservation Foundation, ending that report. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on 6CRA, Great Southern FM in Albany, Western Australia. The new Aged Care Act came into effect at the beginning of November, and community organisations welcomed the new bill protecting older Australians. The Council on the Ageing, or CODA, says this is a positive step towards the needs of ageing Australians. The Act includes more protections to speak up about concerns without reprisal and gives the sector a better control over their care, lifestyle and decisions. The Wire's contributor from 3MDR, John Weeks, spoke with CEO of CODA, Ben Rogers, to find out more.
With the Aged Care Act coming into effect on the 1st November, you know, it's a really key milestone in the delivery of the vision and promise from the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety. And there's a number of great, great reforms coming into effect, including strengthened standards, updated assessment, and a whole new statement of rights. But but. There's always a but.
Yeah.
And look, it's fair to say that one of the cornerstones of these reforms is the introduction of Support at Home program, which replaces aged home care packages.
Yes.
And it's designed to help keep older Victorians and Australians at home for longer, which is really, really important. However, we do have a number of concerns, particularly in relation to, you know, the potential impact of co-contributions. For instance, you know, people will need to make a small payment to support showering at home, potentially, as well as the impact of, you know, what that means regarding hardship, and also how we can make sure that people aren't waiting, you know, too long for their assessment to, you know, delay them receiving the care that they need.
I believe there's, in this whole act, there's a... I guess a charter of aged care rights, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's emphasising like dignity, respect, basically decision-making autonomy for older people. Would that be correct?
Yep. The Statement of Rights includes a whole number of really key things that are meant to be instilled at the heart of all delivery of aged care, whether you're in residential aged care, whether you're in home care, whether you're waiting to be assessed. And that's really, really important that we put the rights of older Victorians and older Australians in this instance first and foremost, and make sure that it's stated. So it's a really great way of making sure that older people and who they are and respecting their decision-making abilities is at the forefront of every part of the system.
You know, there's aged care quality standards here. How good are they?
There's probably a little bit of disagreement on this, but they have, on the whole, been pretty good so far with the introduction of those standards. We're really, really excited about the introduction of the update and strengthened standards on the 1st November because they are higher standards. There are more standards, and I think that's a really important way of making sure that, you know, providers at whatever level are upholding to the best of their ability the services and programs that people need.
Mm.
For instance, there are added requirements around the need to make sure that people are eating food that is, one, healthy for them, but also easy to eat and safe for them to eat, which is really, really important, especially when you're looking towards residential aged care.
Mm.
And the impact that, you know, food can have in a very negative way when older people aren't being looked after, aren't being considered.
And what about the actual service itself, like having a registered nurse requirements and having a 24/7 service that's in place? For people.
It's a really, really key step, I'd say, for a lot of the country. But in particular in Victoria, we've tended to lead the way already with these,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in our public sector residential aged care facilities, who have already had sort of nurse and staffing requirements for a number of years. So it's amazing to see the rest of the country catch up to us, as well as, you know, making sure that there's encouragement at all levels that we can have, you know, the best staffing arrangements to make sure that people's needs are met.
Mm.
So it's a really key step, and we look forward to seeing providers going on that journey across the country.
Mm. So this act, which was passed by the federal government, not a state government, but federal, does that mean that all states will comply to it all, or will there be variations from each state?
So absolutely all states will comply with this legislation and the new aged care system, but there's always a sort of state and territory differences. You know, as I said, in Victoria, we have a public sector residential aged care facilities. We're the only state in the country that has these. And, you know, things can look a little bit different for us because we do have this great resource almost as a backstop, particularly for our rural and regional communities, which is really important. So absolutely every state will follow it, but, you know, it can look a little bit different depending on where you are, and it will look a little bit different in Victoria than, say, compared to New South Wales.
Ben Rogers from the Council of the Aging There, speaking with 3MDR's John Weeks.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
A new report from Salmon Tasmania says salmon sales are on the rise, with more families buying the fish than ever before. But environmental groups say the industry's claims are misleading, pointing to a major salmon mortality event in March and ongoing concerns about large amounts of antibiotics entering waterways. The Wire's Roche V spoke to marine campaigner Alastair Allen from the Bob Brown Foundation to learn more.
The Salmon Tasmania suffered what can only be described as a catastrophic summer last year with a mass mortality in which millions of their own fish died. And the Australian public was alerted to the cruelty and the suffering and the huge environmental impact of industrial salmon farms in Tasmania. And so I think the public has now woken up and is starting to see the true cost of Tasmanian farmed salmon.
The response to the salmon crisis are antibiotics. Are you confident in this new antibiotic treatment practice?
The response to the disease that is that was so devastating last year has to be used huge quantities of antibiotics on these farmed salmon. And that's not to make them healthy and better. That's just to keep them alive long enough before they get killed. The new antibiotic that has been approved for this summer is very controversial. It's called flufenicol. And it has been used in Chile and salmon farms for a long time and has had big impacts on the marine environment. We are seeing here in Tasmania now that the government is recommending that people, if they're concerned about antibiotics, shouldn't fish within 3 kilometres of a fish farm that is being treated, and that's because there can be antibiotics in the wild fish. The fact that they can dump such large quantities in public waterways and let it spread 3 kilometres or maybe even more, we don't know, in public waterways is outrageous.
Do you think consumers are aware of the new antibiotic treatment practices and should there be more education?
As a consumer, you actually would struggle and, in fact, it's really quite hard to know what is in your salmon and where it comes from. For example, salmon from Macquarie Harbour in the west coast of Tasmania is involved with pushing a species to the edge of extinction. But as a consumer, there's no way of knowing that. The same goes for antibiotic use and all the other synthetic dyes and colourings and chemicals that go into this product. As a consumer, there's no way of knowing just how many chemicals have gone into your fish and just how many antibiotics have gone in. And I think it should be right on the front of the label. I think people have a right to know what was used on this fish and what chemicals it has in it. So, yes, I think much further education can be done, but I think supermarkets, both Woolworths, Coles, the big people who are selling this product, have a duty to their customers to make them informed of what's in the product.
What are the impacts of industrial farmed salmon?
The impacts of industrial farmed salmon are wide-ranging, and we're not alone in Australia, in Tasmania. Wherever industrial salmon farms are around the world, whether that be Chile, Norway, Scotland, Iceland, they have the same environmental impacts. And that's because, if you can imagine, there's up to 100,000 fish at a time in a pen, and all their waste and all the nitrogen and all the extra nutrients from those fish is released into the water. The impacts of farmed salmon are huge wherever they are around the world, not just here in Australia. So whether it's Chile, Norway, Scotland, they have big impacts on the marine environment. And that's because they're factory farms. They have up to 100,000 fish swimming in these pens, releasing all their feces, all the extra nutrients into the waterways. And that causes a myriad of implications, whether that be algal blooms, whether that be low oxygen levels, but they also have an impact on wildlife. We just saw in Tasmania 4 dolphins got caught in the nets of the pens and died. They shoot seals. And the list goes on and on, but basically it is a factory farming operation with all its pollution going straight into the marine environment.
Are there alternatives to this practice?
There are alternatives to this practice. We do not need to be farming carnivorous fish such as salmon, which is half of the problem because the inputs required are large. You have to use wild fish, krill from Antarctica. All sorts of extra ingredients have to be used to raise the fish. And secondly, it doesn't need to be done in huge open pens in our marine environment. There are options to bring it onto land and elsewhere. But there's also alternatives with our proteins as well, that we don't have to be consuming so much fish, whether that's farmed or wild caught, because the pressures on the ocean are huge. So doing what we can to reduce our intake of fish is also a great solution and alternative to farmed salmon.
Alistair Allen from the Bob Brown Foundation there, speaking with The Wire's Roche Fee. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.